Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming this this siesta hour, right? Okay. So this is the title of the talk. Maybe it doesn't say much about the content. Let me try to be more precise. I will motivate the talk presenting a very simplified formulation of some problems that arise in the optimal shape design in aeronautics. I mean, for those who are really interested in aeronautics, I should say that this will be really a surface promenade. The way mathematicians see these kind of problems after trying to understand what people do in engineering and also in computational mathematics, as you will see, is full of extremely interesting problems, although most of them are quite hard. Then I will precisely try to point out some of the main difficulties that arise in this field related to the intrinsic complexity of the problems. I will briefly recall you some, you know, standard facts about a traditional discussion about the two possible main approaches or viewpoints to address these problems. And then I will briefly discuss the problem of the presence of shocks, that is something that you cannot avoid, whatever you do. And then finally, I will try to propose, a slight added idea of using this alternating descent method that might be of some help to solve at least some other problems, as you will see. Well, so this is the motivation, as I said. As you know, when you are dealing with optimal shape design, in fact, you end up writing an optimization problem in which your control, the quantity you have to optimize, is the shape, or in this case, of this three-dimensional cavity, is the airfoil. The point of view you take in aeronautics is more, rather than the aircraft is flying, the aircraft is fixed, and the flow is flowing around. So you are trying to find the formations of these three-dimensional cavities so that the flow is under control, so that you maximize or you minimize the quantity you are interested in. In that sense, it's also a control problem. But as I said, and it's indicated in this picture, when you try to do that, you immediately have other difficulties with respect to other classical optimal design problems as related to, for instance, the system of elasticity, and they come from the fact that often solutions of these flow problems develop shocks. And then when you try to deal with shocks, of course, you have to face numerically oscillations, and this is why these two pictures are accompanying the shape of the cavity. So shocks and oscillations, as you will see, will be the main topics. They come as, in control theory, by pairs. Well, before going further, simply tell you that even though there is a long history on this, long tradition on these problems, so from a mathematical point of view, as you know, control theory of PDE is an old subject. People like Jameson did definite contributions to bring these ideas and propose real codes in the frame of aeronautics. Maybe among the mathematicians that were more involved in developing a rigorous mathematical theory, I should mention Olivier Pironneau. But even though there is such a long tradition, the problems are still badly understood. And when you talk to people that practice these kind of things, they will tell you that, nowadays, the existing codes are still far from being able to really do in real time or in a reasonable time to optimize shapes in a real time. In particular, this is related to the huge number of design variables, 100 as I indicate in very typical applications, and also to the geometric complexity of the problem and to the difficulties which are related to solving the surrounding flow equations. But I will come to this later. When you try to summarize what are the tools that show up in this kind of literature, you will see that there are a lot. So PDEs, numerics, optimization, automatic differentiation, modeling issues, boundary layers, geometry, everything is mixed up. And there is a lot also of fine tuning to be done. Very hardly you will find nice convergence theorems telling you that everything is under control. It's far from that. And I will try to emphasize here some of the difficulties which appear when you try to do that as a mathematician. Definitely there is a lot to be done for HOP-like programs in this field. How the problem looks for a mathematician is that way. You have to choose an optimal domain, omega star, within the Euclidean space, R3, say. Of course, omega has to live in a given class of admissible domain. And you have to choose omega so that a given functional is minimized or maximized. And in practice, it can be a drag reduction problem or some kind of economical criteria for the optimality of your airfoil. And, well, there are geometric difficulties, but there is one added major difficulty when you do that in the context of aeronautics, is that the functional J doesn't depend on omega in a, you know, very intuitive and visible way, but rather does it through solving the flow equations in the external domain. And this adds a lot of difficulties, as you will see. Well, as I said, the problem is complex. There are many reasons for that to be the case. One of them is the geometric complexity. For instance, Oscar Bruno was this morning lecturing on this, how you can, you know, somehow cut this airplane on pieces and try to build accurate triangulations or finite element bases for efficient computations. There is also the very important difficulty that mathematicians face when dealing with these problems, is that our intuition about minimization is always conditioned by the fact that we like, you know, nice convex functionals. And these are, you know, this is hardly the case in such a complex application. And then, well, if we want to talk about mathematics, you will see that the number of difficulties you face when doing some analysis on these problems is, I mean, is endless. One of them is that you don't have good existence and uniqueness theory for these problems. As you know, Navier-Stokes in 3D is one of the Clay Foundation problems, except if this weekend it was solved. I think Friday wasn't solved yet. I don't know whether there has been any news in this weekend. As I said, the functionals are far from being convex. If you wanna, well, even if you work hard and you try to, and you succeed on building some kind of iteration so that you get a minimizing or pseudo-minimizing sequence passing to the limit, showing that these domains have a real limit, a domain is hard. So what is the right topology in the class of the domains which corresponds realistically to the application you have in mind, and so that you can do some analysis, is also mainly an open problem. And then, finally, maybe the fact that even though there is a lot of done on numerics for ODEs and PDEs, this is often done for problems in which the parameters are under control. You have your data, your coefficients, your right-hand side, and this is hardly the case in these problems in which everything is moving while you are moving the domain. Well, in any case, if you have to do something, you will end up proceeding as probably everyone else. You will say, well, let us do something. So let me write a descent algorithm so that even if I don't know whether the minimizer exists, I can do it slightly better than before. You know, improving by some percent the existing shapes is already good enough. And for doing that, you will have to, of course, discretize the domain, discretize the PDE, and discretize the functional. That's clear. If you do that, then you will essentially end up with a discrete optimization problem if in a huge dimension, a space. So the number of parameters will be almost endless. If you are rigorous, you will recognize that you don't have any idea about whether the discrete optimizers converge to the continuous optimizers as the mesh size parameter, if there is such a thing, goes to zero. And as I mentioned before, you will encounter a lot of analytical difficulties if you try to develop a, you know, mathematical rigorous proof. And of course, in practice, people are happy if they are able to avoid the divergence of algorithms. And this is often hard to detect. As you know, it will be common that after all this work, you end up getting a picture like this, which is highly oscillatory. One, a good reason for this semester and workshop, right? And as I said before, if you are dealing with a problem that you master well, you know the coefficients, you know the right-hand side, you know the model, the initial data, the geometry, well, even though you get a picture like this, probably you will be able to do some post-processing to make the picture look as you were expecting. But this is very hard to do in optimization problems in which you don't know a priori what the solution is. And this is a picture I like a lot. So maybe I think I have shown this one in a previous workshop or lecture here. But this is, I think this explains very well what's going on. So to some extent, this is the simplest problem you can think of. It's simply the one-dimensional wave equation. This is the chord of one guitar that you are trying to manipulate, to control from one end. So, well, you write down your, you know, continuous model that you can solve. And then by hand, using the Lambert formula or Fourier series, you can find in this particular case that the true solution is a piecewise constant function you can figure out in, you know, behind the first picture over there. It's kind of a bang-bang control taking constant values. You discretize everything with 20 nodes in a finite difference or finite element, you know, discretization of your wave problem. And with 20 nodes, you get something which is oscillating but looks quite nice. You increase a little bit the number of nodes, 40 on the right top over there, and you get a slightly better picture. And then you say, well, let me keep increasing. I should do better. You put 100 nodes, and this is what you get. And with 160, you simply, you know, get a dark, you know, a black hole. This is a situation in which apparently everything has been done right. The functional has been discretized in a very natural way. The numerical scheme is fine, is consistent, is stable, converges. And, you know, the gradient method is also perfect. I mean, you were using something perfectly tested. Despite of that, something is going wrong. Of course, this is related to this interaction between high-frequency components that, you know, move whenever you do one further step in the iteration process and that are hard to control. As I said before, we are used to do it when all the data of the problem are well known, and this is a situation in which this doesn't happen. Now, another difficulty, as I said before, is related to the huge number of parameters in the problem. This is how problems look like. Well, U was the flow equation. If you simplify, you will write simply the flow equation as being AU equal B. B are the data, are given. U is the unknown. Epsilon will be some of the shape parameter, length, curvature, whatever, one of them. Of course, the model depends on the parameter because the domain depends on the parameter, and therefore the solution also depends on this parameter epsilon. You have to build a gradient method, and for doing that, you have to compute derivatives. So let us compute derivatives as we are all used to do. I differentiate with respect to epsilon. You can think of this as being, you know, your preferred of the E or finite dimensional system. You differentiate, and then you recognize here the in blue the main equation, which is giving you the derivative of the solution with respect to this parameter, delta U, as a solution of this linearized problem. And then you say, fine, I can compute it, and I go on. What is the difficulty? The difficulty is that if you have 100 epsilons, 100 parameters, you have to solve this state equation 100 times. So in every step of your gradient iteration, you will need to compute 100 derivatives of your system and solve that system, which looks like the original one. So this is a cause that you can simply not allow when you are doing this kind of aeronautical applications, because every time you do that, this will mean solving an Navier-Stokes equation or an Euler equation in the exterior of this three-dimensional cavity. A second difficulty is related to the fact that often the dependence of the model in epsilon is non-smooth. And this is so, as you know, because most of the numerical, efficient numerical scheme for solving flow equations, they have a lot of limiters that make the scheme to be non-differentiable with respect to any parameter you may have. As I said before, the overall methodology that people use is kind of a fine art in which you are mixing and melting ideas coming from one side and another, and of course convergence is out of reach. Well, this is a nice thing, a joint system. I don't know who was, probably this came from the old Soviet Union. I don't know, Pontryagin, or who invented this great idea of the adjoint system. This is a tremendous shortcut. It's an incredible trick in order to avoid the computation of these 100 derivatives of the state. So using the adjoint system technology, you can replace solving these 100 equations by simply solving one. And this is the idea. Let me remind you. If your functional was something like BUU, some integral of U squared, say, related to the solution U of your model, or the EPDE, or finite dimensional system, the idea is that, well, of course, a way of computing the derivative, delta J, will be to write BU delta U. But if you do that, then you will have to compute delta U for all the parameters. But in fact, you don't want that. The only thing you need is the derivative of the functional. So how can you do it? Well, you can introduce this adjoint system over here, A star P BU. So you put on the right-hand side BU, which is known because you know U and you know B. A star is simply the adjoint system. And then you solve this new variable P. You have to solve that system once. But once you do this, using duality, you can immediately see that BU delta U, which is the derivative of J, is simply P times this quantity that was on the right-hand side of the original system. So you replace solving 100 times the linearized state system by simply solving one time the adjoint system, which looks very much like the original one, plus computing these 100 integrals for the derivative with respect to each parameter. Okay, so we have the main difficulties, some of the main ideas, how to proceed. There are two approaches, as I said before, the continuous and the discrete one. And you have to choose, or you can mix them. But this is the menu. First dish, second dish. So in the first dish, you have the discrete model in which you say, well, I will ignore totally the original PDEs and the original geometry, and I will simply work on the discrete model. The PDE has been replaced by the numerical scheme, the geometry by the mesh, and so on. Okay, if you do that, then the advantage is that you don't have to deal with the PDE. You are dealing with discrete clouds of points. But the drawbacks are that, you know, the geometry is quite invisible over there. It will be, you will have later difficulties to recover the geometry you wanted. And also that this methodology depends very much on the scheme you are using, because whenever you change the scheme for solving your PDE, you have a new discrete model and you have to start again. The second approach is people, you know, that people like continuum mechanics will certainly use, is to say, well, I have the continuous formulation. I do everything at the continuous level, you know, gradient, adjoints, descents, everything I do it at the continuous level. And then at the end, in order to mimic these continuous formulas, I use numerical analysis to replace those continuous quantities by the discrete ones. Okay, you can do that. The advantage is that computations are simpler. As you know, integrating by parts is easier than adding by parts. You can use all the existing theory, sophisticated theory for PDEs, in particular to deal with shocks. But the drawbacks is that if you do that, you are not really computing gradients, you see? Because you had an original continuous gradient that you are replacing by a discrete version. So whenever you do that, you are losing the fact that you are a gradient, and you don't even know whether you are going in the descent direction. Well, you will tell me, you try, and if you don't descend, you go back and you change. Okay, so you can do that. But another added difficulty, and this is the main point I will discuss today, is that this approach is quite subtle if solutions have shocks. Because, again, our intuition is built for solutions of PDEs which are smooth. Well, so you have to deal with shocks. And then you have these two possibilities. First, this discrete approach. And then you don't see the shocks.
And the second dish is continuous approach. You know, shocks make life difficult, and then you have to choose. Either you see them or you don't see them. Okay? But as we have, you know, as we know or know, not facing problems is rarely the best solution.
Well, if you try to retrace the existing theory for, you know, I have here indicated only very few of them that we really used when writing the paper I am telling you about here, you will find very, you know, classical literature as the works by Olenik on the first contributions to shocks, or Kruskov, and then many, you know, celebrated schemes as Engwist-Oscher, and then some more recent work by people that have been really trying to solve this kind of optimization problems related to the presence of shocks. As you all know, when you do fluid mechanics, you have a huge family, again, a very rich menu of equations you can choose. Navier-Stokes equation, Euler equations, reduced models, turbulent models, in which you use sophisticated, you know, boundary layer theory and so on in order to find accurate models at different regimes. And then in the very, you know, in the very first chapter, this is the chapter I will try to present here today, you have this celebrated Barger's equation, which has the advantage of being very easy to manipulate, and that somehow mimics some of the main features of the fluid mechanics equation, has the same scaling. You know, diffusion is competing with nonlinear convection, shocks show up, and so on. Well, you all know about shocks. Solutions develop discontinuities, as they do in real life. This happens for purely hyperbolic models. And of course, there is a very, you know, simple analytical way of avoiding these shocks to appear, is putting some small, you know, amount of Laplacian in your model. But of course, if you do that, then what you get is something which is not a shock, but is a quasi-shock. And life will be as hard with quasi-shocks as with shocks in practice. Of course, you don't avoid difficulties by simply smoothing a little bit out, as you will see. These are the two main, recall you, the Barger's equation with viscosity, the first one, which looks like a nonlinear heat equation, and the second one, which is a nonlinear hyperbolic model, a transport model, in which the added difficulty due to this quadratic nonlinearity is that everybody is not traveling with the same velocity, and this produces shocks. Well, if you are on the frame of the viscous model, you have some small amount of viscosity mu. This is the original equation. You can linearize it very easily. So the only thing you have to do is proceed as you would like to linearize that equation. The only thing you have to do is that, of course, the quadratic term will split in two terms, and you will get a nice linear parabolic equation for the sensitivity of the solution u with respect to the relevant parameter. Okay? This is true as soon as mu is positive, because the solution is say infinity, and this writing is completely rigorous. Of course, we have to keep in mind that when the viscosity is very small, as it could be in practice, then even though solutions are say infinity, they are very close to having shocks. That means that the derivative of u near shocks will be extremely high, and therefore, you know, terms which are well justified over there may have very strong oscillations that might make life difficult. As you know, perfect fluids, Euler equations, or the inviscid Barger's model, we ignore the presence of the viscosity, and there is a very beautiful theory for this. So we know that solutions are unique. Entropy solutions are unique. There are different ways of writing the entropy conditions, and there is a superb proof by Kruskov showing that entropy solutions are unique. And the only, you know, for this first lecture, maybe the only new thing you should keep in mind is that these entropy solutions might be discontinuous. So with respect to the previous lines, you will have serious difficulties to justify how linearization occurs. Indeed, if you write formally what linearization is, you will immediately realize that you have a problem with the second term, in which u being discontinuous, the derivative is a Dirac delta. And on the other hand, if you are computing the sensitivity of a discontinuous function, you expect it to be discontinuous as well. You don't know how to make the multiplication of a discontinuous function times a Dirac delta. Okay? And this is a huge analytical difficulty that you can, in simple 1D problems, you can really solve. You can give a sense to this product by using Wolper's definition of conservative products, and you can build a theory for this measure-valued linearized problem, or measure-valued solutions for linearized problems. There has been work by, in particular, Bouchou, James, Godlewski, Raviar, and also Alberto Bressan on this. But, of course, the theory is far from being complete to multidimensional problem systems, and, I don't even mention the original models that I've seen in aeronautics as, you know, the complete Spallar-Mallah models and so on. Okay, if you look carefully to this literature, you see that a new viewpoint is emerging. And actually, it's very natural. I remind you that, actually, this was already indicated by Rankine-Ugonyo. If you are dealing with Barger's equation, there is the flow solution U, but there is also a very important object, which is precisely the position of the shock, which is moving along this curve over here, which is sigma. In this very simple model, this curve is simply produced by those characteristics that are intersecting, as is indicated in this dark triangle over there. All points in this dark triangle produce characteristics that, after some time, meet at the shock location. So what you have to do in order to characterize solutions, weak solutions of this Barger's equation, is take into account that in order to distinguish the right solution, you have to also add the second equation, the Rankine-Ugonyo equation, which is telling you that the velocity of motion of the shock is related to the solution U itself. So on the right-hand side, you have the jump of the flux, U squared over 2, and then on the left, you have the jump of U. Actually, in this particular case, if you divide by the jump of U, you will simply get the average value of U at the shock as the velocity of motion of the shock. So once you see this, you say, well, maybe I should look at this problem differently. And I should forget about my classical view that the fluid solution was U, maybe with some discontinuities, but rather think on the solution as being a pair. The pair being U, the function itself, the solution of the PDE, but then the second one is the geometric locus of this shock. Okay, so from now on, we will view solutions of this Barger equation as being pairs U phi, U for the solution, phi for the position of the shock. If you accept to do that, then you can linearize the system again. But of course, you have to linearize both equations, the equation for the flow and also the equation for the shock location. And there is, again, a lot of literature on this, starting by the works of Andy Umaida and Bressan and Marson that worked on this for scalar conservation laws and many others. They tell you how to do that rigorously in the class of solutions which are roughly, you know, piecewise regular with some, you know, a smooth interface in between. So this is technically a bit more difficult, but you can do that. And in this way, you find what is the sensitivity of the solution U given by the solution of that linearized PDE delta U, and what is the sensitivity also of the shock locus with respect to changing parameters in the problem, which is given by delta phi. Well, I will tell you how this was tried. People were trying to use this in the past without much success, and precisely our contribution, and this is the short message I would like to pass, is that there is a way of using that efficiently for the Barger's equation, in which you have to go one step further in this idea that you have to distinguish two components on the solution by doing it also in the descent algorithm. So as you will see in the end of my lecture, my recipe is that, well, in agreement with this intuition that the solution is a pair of solution itself plus shock location, when you try to minimize a functional related to this kind of solution, you have to do it in two steps. So in every step of your iteration process, you will actually do two sub-steps. In one of them, you will take care of the shock location, and in the other one, as being, you know, as it is a vectorial problem, take care of the solution of the PDE. Let me give you an example. So this is the simplest one. This is what people call inverse design, in which you are trying to identify an initial datum that will drive the solution at the final time close to a given target that I call UD. D, I think, for maybe decided final objective. How you do that in practice? As I said, you have to discretize. It's very easy to discretize that this time. This is simply the L2 norm of a quantity at a given time, so you discretize in finite differences. You can use the existing theory of finite difference schemes for conservation laws. Most of them look that way. They are written in this conservative form in which delta x is the mesh size in space, delta t in time. And then, of course, the derivative of the flux function is replaced by this discrete derivative. And the only thing you have to make sure in order to guarantee that the scheme is consistent is that the numerical flux function is such that at the diagonal GUU, you reproduce U squared over 2. There are many examples of this. I mean, this is has been a very hot topic for several decades. Let me remind you some of them. The first one is the Lax-Friedrich scheme. The second one is Engquist-Toscher, and the third one is Godunov, LF, EO, and G. There are many others, of course. All of them give you good numerical schemes for solving your PDE. Now, what about the most elementary question? Let us go back. So I am trying to minimize this. Can we guarantee the minimizer exists? If you think on that, you will see that there is a difficulty because, well, let us apply the classical method of the calculus of variation in which you build a minimizing sequence. Then you have to pass to the limit. Of course, the functional will provide L2 bounds, but passing to the limit in the PDE requires something more because the PDE is nonlinear, so weak L2 convergence will never suffice. So if you want to do that rigorously, well, for the continuous theory, there are some ways of avoiding that difficulty. One of them is using this classical unilateral condition proved by Olenik. She proved that the first derivative of the solution U for the Barger's equation is smaller than 1 over T. So this is an upper bound. But actually, if you combine this with the fact that the integral of Ux vanishes, this will also give you a lower bound in average. And if you are careful enough, you will detect from there that you have a BV bound. You have a bound on the total variation of the solutions. And then a bound on the total variation of the solutions allows you to write an L1 version of a Scholier-Sella theorem and pass to the limit in the nonlinear PDE. Well, what about the numerical scheme? Let us try to do the same thing at the level of the numerical scheme to show that the minimizers converge to the continuous minimizer. Then you have to mimic this kind of property. And this has been also done in the literature, but only for, you know, one-dimensional problems and for the most classical schemes as Godunov, Lax-Friedrich, and Tengquist-Toscher. So whether PDEs fulfill this kind of condition in multi-D and whether numerical schemes reproduce it is a completely open subject of research, I would say. The existing work I found is due to Brenier and Osher in 88. Okay, so but going back to the Barger's equation and trying to make things simple in the case we are working on, I can guarantee that due to these earlier contributions, for the Barger's model, in the context we are working, you have this kind of, one-sided discrete version of the Olenik condition that is guaranteeing the compactness of the trajectories and therefore the convergence of minimizers. Well, if you are following the discrete approach, assume you don't want to continue doing nonlinear PDE, so let us choose the discrete approach in the menu. Then you will have to compute derivatives of solutions and then adjoint systems. And this is how they look. Well, you can do that. And it's a bit, you know, long, but no difficulty. You linearize, you differentiate the nonlinear, the numerical flux function with respect to the two variables. You have the the linearized discrete system, and then you take the adjoint. This is pure linear algebra, and you can write also the solution, the discrete model for the adjoint system. There is a difficulty here, though. And when you look carefully to the literature, you see that people have been turning around without ever giving a final answer to this. Is that, as I said before, very often, flow numerical solvers need using numerical fluxes G, which are non-differentiable. Okay? So in practice, people are doing that for fluxes G, which are non-differentiable. Don't ask me how they do it. Many say that they are using automatic differentiation. Okay, you can try to use automatic differentiation, but I don't see how automatic differentiation may help on computing the derivative of the absolute value, for instance, or a discontinuous function at the at the jumping point. Of course, when people do that, they somehow, without saying, they are regularizing the flux functional. But again, you are introducing an added, you know, change on your model that makes things to be even more uncertain. So there is a real difficulty on this. And this is why people, instead of using the discrete approach, they prefer to use the continuous approach. They say, okay, let's go back to the original PDE model, compute the gradient of the functional, and if you do that in the presence of shocks, there is a little surprise. Well, it's not so. Well, we all know that if you compute the derivative of a discontinuous function, you should expect two things, the classical derivative plus a Dirac delta. And this is what happens when you compute the derivative of the functional. You get two pieces, one which is the classical one, the contribution of the solid integral to the derivative, plus another term which is related to the fact that there was a discontinuity on the solution around which you were linearizing and computing the derivative. Okay, if you do that, and you solve, you write the truth adjoint system, you get again an odd, you know, a strange linear hyperbolic problem. It looks that way. Well, the original equation in red is the standard one. You linearize the Barger's equation, you take the adjoint, and you get this hyperbolic linear PDE in which you have dtp plus u dxp equals 0, where the coefficient u now is the solution of the original Barger's equation. But since we have this view that the solution is now a pair solution plus shock, when you do the adjoint, you also have a second equation, which is now telling you that the adjoint equation along the shock should be constant. Okay? And you have initial data at the final time, both for p and also for this value of q along the shock. People have been looking to this strange system for a long time, but in the end, the conclusion is, well, this is the adjoint system of a system which is well-posed, so it should be well-posed. What happens then? And the picture gives you the answer. Well, if you look carefully to the linearized system you find for the adjoint equation, you see the characteristics are the same. But you are solving that system in the backward sense of time, so characteristics are filling all the domain to the right and to the left of this triangle in which the characteristics were colliding. So if you solve the original PDE for P, you will never find the solution within this triangle. So what this second equation along the shock is telling you is what is the true value of the adjoint variable along this red shock. And once you compute that, using the fact that now the characteristics that were colliding at the shock are now emanating from the shock, this will provide you the value of the solution everywhere. So actually, this geometric picture shows you why this system is well-posed. If you do that, these are the kind of solutions you will get. So solution U is a classical solution with a moving shock for the Barger's equation, and then the solution of the adjoint system P, which is similar but not equal, right? Because in this P solution, you identify this intermediate step in which P is taking one value, blue, to the right of this triangle of characteristics entering the shock, red, the value to the left, and then something distinguished in between, right? Okay. So now that we know this, let us continue. So let us build our gradient algorithm. Looking to the value of the functional, you will immediately see that the descent direction is related to P. Actually, it should be minus P at time x0. What happens then? So we had an original u0, and this to this u0, you add a little delta in this direction, P x0. What happens then? You had one discontinuity. And to this discontinuity, you have a function which has two other discontinuities. So what do you get? In the second iteration, you have a function now which a higher complexity has actually three discontinuities. Let us continue one further step of the descent algorithm. Now the solution u has three discontinuities. You take adjoint, and for every discontinuity, you get two more due to the p. So in the second step, you have seven discontinuities and so on. So if you apply this methodology, which is rigorous, is after all this sophisticated analysis of linearization around shocks, you get an increasing number of shocks on the solutions. So that was the point in which I think literature was stuck. All this was well understood, but there was not a clear recipe about what to do. Our contribution was to say something which, on the other hand, is rather natural, is, well, why don't we distinguish among the possible variations of the data those that, first, move the shock, and second, those that do not move the shock at all and simply take care of the profile of the solution away of the shock. If you do that, you can compute that explicitly. And you can see that, indeed, the variations that lead to perturbations of the solution that do not move the shock, as indicated in red, are those for which the original deformation of the shock is compensates that the deformation of the solution away of the shock that will produce. It's given by that formula. Delta phi zero simply related to the motion of the initial datum. If you do that, then the derivative of the function j doesn't involve the shock. The second possibility is to say, well, what are the now deformations of the initial data that move the shock without deformating the solution away of it, delta u at time capital T equals zero. And then you can compute that also. Once you have done that, this is the method we propose. We say, instead of in every step of the gradient iteration using the full knowledge of the adjoint state, which was increasing the number of oscillations in every step, what we propose is, in order to keep the number of shocks on the solution within the iteration constant, we alternate between moving shocks and keeping shocks fixed and deformating solutions. It's simply an extra alternation within each step of the descent method. Well, if we do that, this is what you get. So we were testing how this works for the various methods. I think I have shown you here the Lax-Fried. So in the first one, we are simply using the discrete approach in which you take the Lax-Friedrich scheme, you linearize, and you do everything at the discrete level. On the second example, I mean, on red, you have the Engquist-Oscher scheme. In black, you have the Rho scheme. In blue, you have the full system in which you are imposing these strange internal boundary conditions for the adjoint. And finally, we do our own procedure in which we are alternating in between moving shocks and not moving them at all. As you see, the method wins in the sense that in a few iterations, in five iterations, we go much below what any other scheme can do in 30 iterations. Actually, if you want to understand better what's going on, I think it's better to have a look to this picture. This will be the solution you get for the last, that's right, Engquist-Oscher scheme, the first one on the left, on the top. The second one is using this complete system for the adjoint equation. And then you see that how both of them are introducing more and more shocks and more oscillations within the optimization loop. The result we get by our method is simply this sharp shock. Why? Well, because simply we took care of the shock differently than from the smooth arcs of the solution. There is another, okay, so this is another way of viewing the results. After 30 iterations, the goal here was to move this original guess into the you know, this is a test model in which we knew a priori, we imposed a priori that the optimal solution this will, should be this discontinuous function. We started the iteration with this other discontinuous function. If you use the alternating model process I suggested, you get it right. You get almost the exact solution. While you, if you use any of the other methods, you see how oscillatory solutions are. Of course, the most oscillatory one is Lax-Friedrich. I think they are top on the left. And this one will be the less oscillatory one, which is comparable to this one. I think it's Enquist-Toscher. This will be the one in which you are solving fully the adjoint system. But you see how using this alternating idea avoids all these extra oscillations that the standard processes add. Okay, so now we are trying to do things in multi-D. This is extremely interesting, although difficult, but I think this is a very challenging topic. We have seen that in 1D, the process, the methodology we propose is faster. You don't increase the complexity of solutions while you are iterating. You keep the number of discontinuities bounded a priori. You don't add one oscillation or one discontinuity every time you iterate. And another important, interesting thing about this methodology is that it is rather independent of the numerical scheme you are using, in the sense that we are completely distinguishing how you move shocks and how you modify, correct the solution away of them. So while you are working away of the shock, you can basically use any convergent algorithm, not necessarily the adjoint of the original one. You can take a much simpler algorithm because you are on those parts of the solutions which are not so sensitive to precisely the algorithm you are using. So in multi-D, I have shown you this picture in which you have a shock along a line evolving in time. So this will be a surface. By now, the only thing I can tell you is that when you compute what is the linearization of equations along in the presence of these shocks, what you see, according to what I have told you before in 1D, what you see is, again, three different things. One, now the shock is a surface evolving in time, so it's a curve evolving in time, so it will be a 2D surface in a three-dimensional space. Then for the sensitivity of the shock, what you have is an hyperbolic equation on that surface. And then away from it, you will have the standard linearization of your PDE to the left and to the right. So that the methodology I have proposed can be extended to that setting, except for the fact that now you have to be very careful about shock location and then solving this hyperbolic PDE along this shock. But in any case, in view of the numerical results I have shown you in 1D, it is very likely that doing that way will improve the existing results, because you see, what happens to the optimization process if you follow the classical strategies that are ignoring the fact that the shock is in there, you are replacing systematically the shock by oscillations. You do that every time you iterate, and therefore the defect of the method is increasing in every step. And this makes, you know, iterations to be very slow, as you see over there, and simply not very efficient, because they stay much farther than they could be from the final target. So, in principle, this is a methodology that could be fully applied to multidimensional problems, except for the difficulties I have mentioned to you. How you detect shocks, how you build the geometry of the shock locus, and then how to solve the hyperbolic equation. We have simply a few preliminary tests on this, which are promising. This really, you know, in this picture, I am showing you how you can slightly improve existing results if you make a, you know, a very rudimentary use of these ideas, but nothing systematic. And well, the only thing I can say is that this is a very promising subject. And to conclude, simply to indicate that there is a, in this field, as I have tried to show you, there is a lot to be done for HOP, involving HOP topics. In particular, there is a lot to be done on the well-posedness of the relevant models, as I have said. Nonlinear PDEs in this field are difficult. There is also a lot to be done for developing right numerical schemes. One of the major difficulties in this field is that there has been a lot done for building good numerical solvers for the original PDEs, but not so much for the linearized PDEs or for the adjoint PDEs. And as you have seen, the geometry of solutions of the adjoint PDE is different from the original ones. In the original one, we expect shocks. But then in the adjoint equations, we see that there are these dark regions that the classical numerical solvers don't actually find well. So there is a lot to be done in order to develop adapted numerical schemes for solving this kind of dual bizarre equations. Of course, there is also much to be done about developing rigorous proofs of the convergence of the descent algorithms I have given you. I have built a numerical algorithm, a descent algorithm, an iteration. It is working well. Now, whether it converges or not, I don't know. Actually, I don't know how you prove convergence of this kind of descent algorithms for nonlinear problems. Well, probably you have to use some kind of discrete Lyapunov function to show that, necessarily you have to converge to some stationary point. Whether you can do that when you are alternating in the frame of nonlinear conservation laws, I don't know. So even for the very elementary example I have shown you, proving rigorously the convergence of the numerical algorithm is not so clear. What I have told you is that the numerical, the discrete optima converges to the continuous optima. And then in practice, I was trying to search the discrete optimum. But I didn't, right? I only gave an iteration in order to approach that. Whether this iteration actually converges to the continuous minimizer, I still don't know. And then, of course, when you talk to engineers in this field, you realize how, you know, important the work has been, to be done is in order to really be able to transfer some of this, you know, mathematical understanding into real applications and real codes. So I think there is another one. Yes, so the last one was simply to thank the I had the luck of being here not only for this week, but for a few months, so it was really great. And I would like to thank the organizers that did a very good job, in particular Arie. In fact, I think Arie was the one in charge of the weather. So I complained several times about this, but no success. I see you compete well with November weather in Madrid. And also thank the Institute and all colleagues and audience for being here today.
Okay. We have time for some questions.
So if you have shocks and this contact discontinuity, do you monitor both shock and contact discontinuity, or just only monitor the shock?
That's a good question. So, in fact, here I have shown you only one example in which I have put, you see, this is a fake example, right? Because I knew the solution had one shock and I had put one shock to start with. You can apply this methodology in any situation. You can say, well, my initial datum has n shocks and the target has m shocks, and you will, by this method, you improve what classical methods do. But of course, the best situations are those in which a priori you have an initial guess which is well adapted to the target you are considering. So you have to, of course, I should have said that initializing correctly this iteration process is very important in order to make the method effective. But again, if you start from any other initial latun, all the experiments we have done work much better than this in this way that they will do if you ignore the shocks and you proceed by the standard methodology using, Lachs Friedrich or Rengwist-Oscher schemes. All of them, fill everything by oscillations, and then functionals have serious difficulties to descend. Okay? Now, of course, if you compare the efficiency of this method within, for instance, an example in which solutions are smooth, I mean, the gain is very small, right? But as soon as solutions really develop shocks, this is much more efficient.
Okay.
So when I see this, then it reminds me of a typical ill-posed problem. So, and probably a hyperbolic evolution with shocks is an ill-posed problem, because at the shocks you destroy information. And so can you also view your approach from the point of view as of regularization by means of removing degrees of freedom? So regularization by discretization. Here, when you, and with many ill-posed problems, you see the same behavior. When you use a fine discretization, then your solution is just swamped by oscillation. Mm-hmm. When you use a coarse discretization, you recover something meaningful. So this is a standard regularization strategy. You reduce your degrees of freedom so that you suppress unwanted information.
I think you are right.
Meaningless information.
I think you are right. So the main debate on this kind of literature has been about what to do with this strange adjoint system. Mm-hmm. People were discussing whether, for instance, adding viscosity will do better or not, right? Because a natural way of avoiding the shock will be to put the viscosity on the original equation.
Oh, but this won't help.
But of course, these kind of things don't help. So precisely as you said, one way of viewing that will be to say we are indeed adding some kind of beacon of regularization, if you like to, by restricting the class of gradients to these families in which the geometry of the solutions is has less complexity. You are right.
Well, I would call it regularization by discretization. Well, because instead of admitting, well, very generally initial data, you restrict yourself to a very...
It's not only this, right? Well, the way I see it is not only this, because, what you said could be interpreted as simply following the discrete approach, and this doesn't work.
No, I mean...
If you simply discretize and you proceed by the discrete method, the classical discrete method, you get all these wiggles. Yeah.
This is not my point.
Yeah.
This is another level of discretization. You restrict the space
of admissible
initial data to step functions.
Yeah.
And then you naturally get rid of all meaningless solutions.
That's a way of seeing. I think we were more inspired by what people do in elasticity, in which you see that, in order to build optimal shapes, of course you have to shape the external boundary, but very often you are also interested on making perforations. So the way you do that, you have classical derivatives. Hadamard did that already about solutions of PDEs with respect to the formations of the exterior boundaries, and you have also topological derivatives. But people don't do that in one single step, but they are alternating, right? So you do a number of iterations making external deformations of the boundary, and every 10 iterations, say, you decide whether, using topological derivatives, you are interested on putting holes or removing them. And that was our motivation, somehow make distinguishing between the formations of the smooth arcs and then taking care of the shock locus.
So, but it seems you arrived at a solution that you can also arrive at from the point of view of an inverse problem.
This was an inverse problem, right? Mm-hmm. So in this case, that was precisely the inverse design problem, which I am trying to detect the initial datum in order to reach a goal. Of course, making all this, and this was what I was showing you, making all this in a real application, this is what we are trying to do. But you learn a lot from what I said. So once you understand, and this is as you did in your interpretation, what's going on, you understand a lot, because you immediately realize that when you are making the formations of the shape of this 2D section of the airfoil, you have to distinguish those that move the shock and those that do not. And then by some continuous analysis, you can indeed, trying to split the space of the formations into these two classes and alternate. And as soon as you do that, you see how, things improve.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker. Okay.